Shalom, shalom. Today is November 7th, and delighted to have you all here. This is the first session of a course that will explore Zionism in Israel by focusing on several key milestones. I'm going to be saying a few things that I want to be sure everyone hears now, although I will be repeating them if necessary. One is that this is not, it's not a history class, although we're going to be focusing on certain key moments in history. A number of times we're going to be, many people here may be asking a question, gee, what actually led to this or led to that? And my response might be, well, there are some good books you can consult and take a look at them. Not because I don't care about the answers, but because our focus really is, how did we get to where we are? And how is this going to help us understand and move into the future? So it's not of just antiquarian interest that we're here. We're here because Israel is a looming, large subject of our attention and of our energy. And we want to gain this background in order to be better capable of not just talking about, but maybe actually doing in the present and in the future. Okay. Before I go any further, did we run out of those packets or of those sheets that went around? Did they? We're short one. Okay. Can I have the packet, please? And I'm going to ask somebody to go to the office and just make, yeah, well, you can, but if you can figure out how to use that Xerox machine, really, the Messiah has come. And also, do we have an extra copy of this sheet also?
I think we have plenty of them.
Rabbi,
okay.
We can share one. You're missing one.
They can share them. Then let me give this to you for now, and then we'll make more for after.
You're making me look bad because I'm not sharing my life.
Well, you know, there used to be this wonderful show, The Dating Game. And enough said about that. Okay, let me say a few words about what people on the other side there, what this course is all about, and how it came to be. The Hartman Institute. What are we going to? Oh. The Hartman Institute is a major educational institution in Israel. It was founded by the late Rabbi David Hartman in memory of his father, Shalom Hartman. So it's called Machon, which means foundation, Machon Shalom Hartman, Yerushalayim. He was an American who made, as it were, Aliyah to Canada. And then after serving in a large congregation in Canada for a number of years, he and his family made Aliyah in 1967. And even during his lifetime, work in leading the institution had already begun to shift to his son, Daniel Hartman, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman, who has in fact succeeded his father as the director of the institution, certainly since his death. It began really as a kind of an eclectic, unusual yeshiva for rabbis of different denominations, scholars of different religious orientations to get together and talk. It really was a think tank in its early years. It became a place which ran programs for rabbis of all denominations, which is, of course, very unusual in Israel, because Israel is highly denominational. Who would come in the summer and learn there. And I was one of those who went and learned there from wonderful scholars at the Hebrew University and elsewhere. Then it began a program which was a three-year fellowship program that I participated in, bringing me to Israel twice each year for 3 years with weekly video conference calls that were supplemented with other materials, and at the conclusion of which I became a senior rabbinic fellow of the Institute. And that's a wonderful program. It also runs a yeshiva high school for boys, a yeshiva high school for girls, though they are Orthodox, they're very pluralistic. It runs programs for Muslim scholars, for Christian scholars. Some of you may know of James Carroll. He's a writer, a theologian, an op-ed writer for The Globe. He has studied there. In fact, he wrote a beautiful obituary for Rabbi David Hartman after his death. And it really is a place that very much wants to use the learning of the past as a way of understanding the future. Whence this program, this series of courses called I Engage Israel. A number of years ago, the scholars at the Hartman Institute became aware, as all of us are aware, that talking about Israel is a very, very contentious, challenging, difficult, draining experience here in America because feelings run high, emotions run high. Sometimes people don't necessarily know facts, or if they know facts, they don't know the same facts as people that they're talking with. And it's a sorry state that we really can't talk about something that's so, so precious to so many of us and about which we care so much. So among the programs for, as they say, Jews in the pews, in other words, non-professional Jews, non-rabbis, non-cantors, non-educators, was a series of lectures, and then they turned into the first of the I Engage curricular units. We taught one of these a number of years ago, so some of you may have been in that class. This one was inspired by this really interesting coincidence that this year we observe the 120th anniversary of the first Zionist Congress in 1897, the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration in 1917, the 70th anniversary of the UN Partition Plan in November 29th, 1947, and the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. So given those milestones, it seemed like a really interesting way of talking about Israel. Again, talking about those milestones, but for the most part trying to help us come to grips with the present and move to the future in a way that's benefiting from our multiplicity of opinions and our multiplicity of viewpoints. Pluralism is a very interesting word. It's one of the words that is really one of the bedrocks of the Hartman Institute. The notion of pluralism means that you don't have to be wrong for me to be right. I mean, I can be right and you can be right in different ways. By the way, this tends to work in marriages too, but it certainly works in situations like this. In other words, there are truths, there's value, there's what to learn from different perspectives. As you know, within religious institutions, that's very rare. So the Hartman Institute really is on the forefront of what I'd call pluralistic Jewish education. These programs are set up with essentially four different units, and I want to go into them because you are going to have some impact on just how we are going to move through this material. Let me explain. Within a few days, we will be receiving, each of us will be receiving a course packet. They have not yet arrived. That's why you have a photocopy of just the first few pages from IX through the end of the Roman numerals up to page 5 in a packet here, okay? That's the first 5 or 7 pages of what I think is a 200-page packet, so don't get scared by it, but it's very, very large, the actual course packet. But that's only one piece of this curriculum. Each unit has the following elements, and we're going to be going through them, but you're going to have some influence in how we go through them. Each course unit includes some texts to preview and to review, and we'll see those in a moment when we look at the first unit. So if you take a look at, just for a moment, pages 2 through 5. Those are texts. Those texts are listed on page 1. So if you just look at page 1 for a moment, they include 9 texts that are called texts. and then background reading. I didn't photocopy for you the background reading for this material. That's another 15 pages. I have it. You will be able tonight, as soon as tonight, to download it all, of course. It's all online. You could get access to anything. But you will have a hard copy of it all as soon as those packets come through. But for tonight's class, I felt it was important for you at least to have pages 1 to 5. Okay? If at the conclusion of this class tonight you are still interested in taking this class, you simply go to this Hartman Online, follow the signs, you create an account, you have the community registration code, and you can access your account at any time. That means you can not only read these materials online if you wish, but you can also access the other materials that I'm about to discuss. Okay? Each unit not only has texts, which generally are studied by the class in what's called chavruta, which is dyads or triads prior to anything further. And then there is a lecture for each unit, which is about 30 minutes, which is spoken by Professor Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman. Okay? Then there is also another video unit, which is a roundtable discussion with Rabbi Hartman and other scholars who are part of the iEngage research team. These include Yehuda Kurtzer, who's the head of the Hartman Institute American branch that focuses a lot on training and education here in America. It includes Yossi Klein Halevi, includes Alana Stein-Hain, it includes Michal Biton, and these are very interesting scholars and thinkers whom we will come to know better as the course proceeds. When typically this course, and I apologize that this is a lengthy introduction, but you'll understand why in a moment. When this course is typically conducted, it's conducted on, let's say, a Sunday morning. Maybe it'll be 2.5 to 3 hours for each unit. We don't have 2.5 to 3 hours. You know, rapid eye movement begins at around 9:15 among most of us. And so that requires us to do some cutting and pasting. This first unit, we are going to study over the course of these next two sessions. We're not going to squeeze it all into one. But that would include my introduction and then listening to Rabbi Hartman's introduction, his introductory lecture, and then discussing it. And then next week, watching the roundtable discussion and discussing that. Now, here's where you come in. We're going to try this tonight, and we're going to see how that goes. Some people find it a wonderful experience to watch these videos as a class. Other people would rather watch it on their own when they're exercising on their bike or whatever. And the thought of being in a room with the lights low at night watching a video is frightening because it can induce can have a soporific effect. So we're going to see how things go, and you let me know. And after we go through the first unit, we can tweak this model, okay? Because when we taught this last time, we didn't watch the whole video of each session. We watched excerpts, and we assumed that more people were watching it ahead of time. So part of this question is how much work are people prepared to do outside of class, and part of it has to do with when and how to absorb this material. Okay. So, any questions? Okay. So, moving right along, what I'd like to do is to introduce the subject that we're going to be looking at tonight, and then turning it over to the video and watching Daniel Hartman's lecture. I should point out, I want to thank Sharon and Marie in our office. When I came to do a test run of all of this, nothing worked. My computer didn't connect with this. The speaker I had brought did not work. Nothing worked. And so we have a different computer. The speaker is apparently coming right out of this machine. And hopefully you'll be able to hear everything. Okay. Let me pass this around. Some of you were able to be in synagogue this past Shabbat morning when I spoke about the Balfour Declaration, but I'm going to say a few words leading up to that, and then we're going to watch we're going to read a few texts and watch the first video. Let me begin, though, by saying that one of the key reasons that we're looking at this material is not because we are Israelophiles. It's not because we're interested in Israel, per se. It's because...
I'm sorry.
It's because we're Jews, and we're interested in Judaism. So one key question is, what is Judaism? I mean, it's a serious question. Like, when we think about this thing called Judaism, we won't necessarily all agree on what it is. And there are different models. There are different ways of understanding what Judaism is. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. Maybe the best way to think about it, one of the ways I like to think about it, is to think about the word Jewish. What is the noun of which Jewish is the adjective? Dun, 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 dun. Dun, da, 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 da. What do you think? What is the noun of which Jewish is the adjective?
Jewish.
Well, why don't we raise our hands and then we can all... Yes?
Hebrew.
Well, that is an interesting... You're sort of translating things into a different idiom. I'm thinking about just the English word Jewish. What is the noun of which Jewish is the adjective? Hold on, David. I want to see... Yes?
People.
Why do you say that? Because you're saying Jewish is an adjective and it applies to people. So what would be the noun form of Jewish?
Yes.
Good. Okay. You got it?
No.
Jewish applies to the people, the Jewish people. Therefore, the noun form of Jewish is Jew. Everybody hear that? Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you have a hand up to suggest a different answer to the question?
No.
It could be Judaism. So, in other words, Jewish could be an adjective modifying not certain people, but what? Certain ideals, certain beliefs, certain...
culture.
A culture, certain practices, right? I mean, we all know this, that you can say, he's Jewish, referring to a person, but you can also say... I'm sorry?
Nothing else.
Or you can also say... Oh, this practice is a Jewish practice. It doesn't mean, by the way, that every Jew does it. In fact, very few Jews may be doing it. But we call it a Jewish practice because it applies to this system, this collection of ideals that we call Judaism. Okay? Now, that may seem like a very simple distinction, but it actually has very powerful ramifications. Because one key question is, at any different era, you know, you might have two people who meet each other, and one says, I'm Jewish, and the other says, I'm Jewish. And the first one means one thing, and the second one means something very, very different. Okay? Rabbi Hartman has a particular way of distinguishing between those two ways of understanding what it means to be Jewish, and he uses a typology that I think is a little confusing, so that's why I'm going to introduce it and translate it for you right now. Okay. And by the way, I also am curious whether you like the arrangement of the seats and the tables. Some people like tables, that they can't go anywhere without them, but it does mean that we're kind of far away from each other, and if we were to be just having seats here, it'd be a lot more cozy, but you wouldn't have as many surfaces to put out there. Okay, so one kind of understanding of Judaism focuses on what it means to be part of a people. Okay? And he calls that the Judaism... Okay, we're going to switch over... Things are really going really well here. Judaism of belonging. Okay? The Judaism of belonging is what he calls this notion of kinship and of common concern. and of common destiny. Okay? He also, though, is aware, and this is going to be a little confusing because he uses the word Judaism to refer to, you know, both kinds of conceptions here. He also recognizes that, you know, we are trying in many religious institutions not just to teach about kinship, but to teach about ideals, proper behavior, proper belief, okay, culture, and that he calls the Judaism, I'm going to abbreviate that JM, of becoming, with the notion that, in other words, if you have a set of ideals and of beliefs and of practices, then you're on a road to becoming a different kind of a person in some sense. Okay? I personally find that notion of becoming kind of, I don't quite get it as being as obvious as belonging, but we're going to work our way through the text and we're going to see how that translates out. Now, before we watch his lecture, I want to just review with you a couple of these texts that are in our packets. Now, ordinarily, we would maybe take a half hour and have each of you in dyads or triads look at these. Today, we're kind of moving it along so that we can get to the video lecture, which is longer than usual because it's also an introduction to the course. And we're going to look at it together as one large chavrusha. So let's take a look at the first text on page 2. Now, this is a text, actually, it's from last week's Torah reading. One second. Da. Okay, and, you know, this is the Akedah, this is the binding of Isaac, and at the end of the scene of the binding of Isaac, an angel comes down, and after all, Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son, so God speaks to Abraham. And look at what he says in verse 17. Do you see verse 17? He says, I will bestow my blessing upon you. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands on the seashore. And your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes. It's very interesting. This is a promise to Abraham. Who's the beneficiary of this promise, by the way?
Progeny.
The progeny. All those kindelach, right? All the progeny, all the descendants are going to have it really, really well, right? And by the way, what do the progeny, what do the descendants have to do in order to warrant this great, great reward? What's their obligation? Does it say that here?
No.
Doesn't say it here.
Right.
Doesn't say it here. Right? Doesn't say it here.
Oh,
maybe it's applied. But it's not explicit here in this text. I don't see it. It just says, you have done this, and therefore I'm going to bestow a blessing. You're going to have lots of descendants. They're going to have, you know, great time. No problem in the world. No explicit quid pro quo.
So it is the quid pro quo for the original act.
No explicit, excuse me, David, no explicit quid pro quo for the descendants.
Yes.
Thank you. I just need to finish the sentence sometimes. Thank David, thank you. No requirement on all of us, right? We are descended from Abraham, and therefore we are to be blessed. That's a unilateral blessing, and it comes to us because we belong. We belong to the kin. We belong to the kinship circle. That's the Judaism of belonging. Guess what? We're the children of Abraham. Boom. This is ours. Okay. But that's not the only text in the Torah, of course. And there are other texts that sort of imply a different understanding of what it means to be a Jew, what it means to benefit from being a Jew. Take a look at the text from Exodus that's immediately below. Exodus 19, 1-6. This text, by the way, these two chapters are great, great read. And I recommend we read it on Shavuot because Exodus 19 tells us gives us the scene of the giving of the Ten Commandments, and chapter 20 gives us the contents of the Ten Commandments. Okay? So in this scene, the children of Israel are in the wilderness. They get close to the wilderness of Sinai, and Moses goes up to talk to God, and God speaks, and God says, and let's go to verse 5. Let's go to verse 5. What does God say? Now then, if you will obey me faithfully and keep my covenant — a covenant is a fancy word for an agreement, an understanding, a deal — you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples. Indeed, the earth is mine, but you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay. So here, a promise is being given to the people, but it's not the same kind of a promise. How would you describe this promise? How would you describe this promise? What kind of a promise is this? If the first one up above was a unilateral promise, what kind of a promise is this? Yeah.
Conditional.
It's a conditional promise. It's conditional. If you obey me, keep my covenant, then wonderful things are going to happen to you. This suggests a different understanding of what it means to be a Jew. It's not enough just to be a part of this kinship circle. You actually have to do something. You have to actually, you know, stick to your part of the bargain.
Isn't that a violation of the previous deal? Isn't that a breach of contract?
You know, the short answer is that the text of the Torah is filled with different voices, and it's filled with different, you know, understandings. This is a different understanding that exists, that coexists with the first one.
How does it coexist as opposed to change?
Because the first one still continues on.
So don't keep the covenant, you still...
Well, I'm going to hold you back on this one, because the point is that you will find in different parts of the Bible, you'll find in different eras of Jewish history, different emphases on these two different covenants. One a unilateral covenant, and one a more conditional covenant. One focusing on the Judaism of belonging, the other focusing on the Judaism of becoming. Let me say this, there are other ways of describing this difference, and the way I like to look at this difference, you know, and this may be this may not be particularly helpful now, but I'm going to throw it out because we'll be using it a little bit later, is that within Judaism, what we call Judaism, on the one hand, there are some elements that are very, very parochial. Do you know what that word means? I always used to think it was a synonym for Christian, because I knew kids who went to parochial school. So that's what but parochial means... very narrowly focused on you and your particular kinship circle. So you have a parochial element within Judaism, just about Jews, and then you have universal elements within Judaism that focus on all humanity. There is a spectrum, in other words, within what we call Judaism, and some elements are way over here, and some elements are way over here. Okay? Give me an element of Judaism that's way over here. That's a parochial element. Has to do with Jews, people who are identified as Jews.
Kashrut.
Okay, good. In other words, refraining from shellfish. You can be, or whatever it might be, bacon. We can list all the fun tray foods that we're not supposed to eat. Yes, I'm sorry.
It talks about slaves. If you're a non-Jewish slave, then you can get less benefits, like on the seventh year.
Okay. I'm going to hold that off because I want to try to stick to something that's contemporary that we all experience now. We don't see that now.
You're supposed to just adopt the first to Jews.
Say that again? Okay, so in other words, preferences in tzedakah or in caring. Yes, so there are definitely parochial elements, not only in specific mitzvot, in specific practices, but in perhaps the way in which we give a hierarchy of practices. But give me a couple of universal elements in Judaism today. Okay, one sec. Howard.
Feed the poor, help the stranger.
Okay, so in other words, feed the poor, help the stranger. In other words, Howard's suggesting we've got a bunch of laws that suggest we're supposed to help other people, although, as you were suggesting, there might be a prioritization. What Mark was saying was, well, what about tikkun olam? The reason I'm holding off on that is we're not all sure we know what that means. Okay, that's a very curious term. But other universal aspects of Judaism.
All the Ten Commandments are universal.
Well, not all the Ten Commandments are all that universal. Honor the Sabbath day to keep it holy, right? I mean, we have people who don't observe the Sabbath, right? But certainly there are universal mitzvot in the Ten Commandments, such as?
Don't
Thou shalt not murder. Excuse me. No, you're allowed to kill. You just can't murder. Okay? Thou shalt not murder. Okay? No. And then certainly don't bear false witness. All of those seem to be very, very universal. So we're going to see that in every generation, and no matter what issue we're worried about or we're focused on, we're going to see different perspectives. And so it isn't as if you're just a Jew of belonging and you're not a Jew of becoming, or you're just a Jew of becoming and you're not a Jew of belonging. You're going to see we're going to sort of be pulling from both of those strands at the same time. Yes, Candace?
Honor my mother and my mother.
Honor thy father and thy mother. It says honor thy father and thy mother, but it says fear your mother and your father. Okay, so yes, those are the universal. Certainly, the way that's phrased is incredibly universal. Okay, so that's one point I wanted to just make, that we are the heirs to a tradition that recognizes, on the one hand, that we have responsibilities and obligations that give us this unique relationship with God, and on the other hand, we're yidden. Okay, now turn the page, and we see this expressed in a really interesting way in a text that is extremely familiar to all of us, but that we may not have thought about in this way, and that is the Pesach Haggadah. Everybody here has heard of the Pesach Haggadah? Okay, it comes right before the brisket. You have the Haggadah, right? So the Haggadah lists the four children, okay? The wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who does not know how to ask it. So look at how the wise child is distinguished, and look at how the wicked is distinguished. We're going to learn something. I'm going to ask you, what Judaism, is it the Judaism of belonging or the Judaism of becoming, that is in the back of the mind of the author of this text? Let's take a look at the first one. Who'd like to read the wise one? You've all read it once or twice at a Seder. So who would like to read it? In English, please. Marla, I'm not just looking at you, but if you'd like to do it, feel free.
What are the testimonies, the statutes, and the laws which the Lord our God has commanded you? You in turn shall instruct him in the laws of Passover. One is not to eat any dessert after.
Right, now what kind of Judaism is the author of that text focused on? Is this the Judaism of belonging, that all that really matters is that we're part of this kinship circle? Or is it the Judaism becoming, where we really focus on, like, what do you know, what do? What do you believe? Okay? It's becoming, and, you know, to such an extent that the most punctilious, the teeny tiniest of obligations is the focus of the wise child, right? He goes so far as to tell you, don't eat anything after the dessert. You know, you can't have anything after the afikoman. Okay. Now let's take a look at the wicked child. Who would like to read, don't take it personally, but who'd like to read the wicked child? Bruce, do you want to try it?
What is this service to you? He says, to you, but not to him. By thus excluding himself from the community, he is a heretic in the essence. You therefore blunt his teeth and say to him, it is because of this that the Lord did for me when I left Egypt. For me, but not for him. If he had been there, he would not have been redeemed.
Okay. What kind of Judaism is in the back of the mind of the author of that paragraph? Is it the Judaism of belonging or the Judaism of becoming? Let me just hear. Okay.
I think it's belonging.
Why?
Because he's talking about the fact that God not being there for him. Like,
yeah, think about this. Look how powerful this. By thus excluding himself from the community, he is a heretic in the essence. So it's not even that he has, think about it, he hasn't violated a particular rule of Judaism. He has, however, excluded himself from the group. Yes, David?
I'm a little bit confused because they criticized the second child for using you, but didn't the first child use you also?
We can talk about that on another occasion. Well, we're not going to take time on that. You're absolutely right. The text does read to you in both this, but the emphasis, the focus is in one case on one and on the other. They're different verbs. They're actually different words in Hebrew. Okay? They're actually different words in Hebrew. In the case of the first one, it's etchem, and in the other one, it's lachem. So they have different forces in Hebrew. Don't translate as easily. Now, if you really are not sure, if you're wondering, is this really a focus on the Judaism of belonging and not on becoming, you must read Maimonides' text that immediately follows, which is astounding, actually. So I'm going to read this out loud, okay? You see this, Maimonides' Laws of Repentance?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to hear from Maimonides just how important is this notion of belonging. Listen to this. A person who separates himself from the community, bracket, may be placed in this category. What's the category? The category that's being explored in that text are irremediably, how would I put it? Distant people, people who are not worthy of our consideration, basically. Unworthy.
Pariah.
I beg your pardon? Yeah. Listen to what he says. Because these are all people who don't have a place in the world to come. There's a whole list of people who don't have a place in the world to come, including, by the way, people who deny that there's a world to come. Look, I mean, why should they have a place there, right? If they deny it, they shouldn't be there, right? But listen to who belongs in this list. Someone who separates himself from the community. These next few words are very important. Even though he has not transgressed any sins. That's an amazing thing. Think about it. Someone who is so punctilious, he eats all the kosher food. He doesn't eat the non-kosher food. He observes Shabbat. He reads Torah. He studies. Okay, fulfills all the mitzvot except in one respect. What does he do? He excludes himself from the group. He doesn't use the word us when referring to the Jews. What happens to him? He's out. He has no place in the world to come. And he expands it because Maimonides is a thoughtful guy, so he wants to actually help make sure that we understand this. He says, a person who separates himself from the congregation of Israel and does not fulfill mitzvot together with them, does not take part in their hardships or join in their communal fasts, but rather goes on his own individual path as if he's from another nation and not from the Jewish people, he does not have a portion of the world to come. So this is a remarkable expression. It's a very poetic expression of just how significant the Judaism of belonging is within what we call normative Judaism. Again, Maimonides certainly believed in mitzvot. He certainly believed in the Judaism of becoming. But you see how important belonging is. And so the reason I'm making such an emphasis here on that distinction is that, as we're going to see, when it comes to the thought of, the vision of a Jewish homeland, is it primarily about the Judaism of belonging, or is it about the Judaism of becoming? What kind of a homeland are we looking for? What kind of a place is at the end of the rainbow? What do you think?
Belonging.
Why?
Because it is a place where you belong.
Ah, so if I can quote Robert Frost, what is true about home? Home is where they have to take you in, right? Remember that? Home is where they have to take you in. So, you know, if the key issue for Jews in the latter part of the 19th century, when Zionism arose, if the key issue for Jews is a sense of not being at home, and certainly that is how Jews felt in Europe. That's actually how Jews felt all over the world, right? If that's the key issue, then what are you looking for? You're looking for a place where we can feel at home. At-homeness is a key element here, okay? But what if you're looking at it differently? What if you're looking at the fact that as a Jew in the world and not in our own land, we can't practice Judaism freely? We can't be free to behave the way, because we're strange, we're different. People don't like us doing what we're doing. We're looking for a place where not just Jews can flourish, but where Judaism can flourish. Do you see the distinction between the two? That's very important, because if you don't appreciate that distinction, you won't understand how there can be different kinds of Zionists. Zionists who are super focused on Israel being a refuge, and those who are super focused on it being a place where Judaism can flourish. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Okay, very quick, I want to just looking at the time, want to just very quickly move to the text of the Balfour Declaration. You've all seen the text of the Balfour Declaration. I included it in my email. I know that everyone gets a million emails, but emails for me, I know you read every word, right? So you therefore have read the Balfour Declaration. I want you to look at something. The text of it is here, and it is striking. It is striking. And by the way, I don't know if you could do this, Stephen, but could you open the door back there a little bit of air in here, because it's a little bit warm. I don't know if we could put like a chair or something, a little bit of a breeze. Thank you. So we have this wonderful letter from Lord Balfour, member of the House of Lords, representing the cabinet in 1917. Britain is in charge of the Near East, but its soldiers are advancing on the land of Israel. They're coming very close to conquering it, and they issue this declaration. And the declaration is, you know what? We view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Are they thinking about the Judaism of belonging or the Judaism of becoming? They're focusing on belonging, because they're focusing on getting a homeland for these Yidden who are all over Europe and who presumably don't belong there. And by the way, it's a very interesting way that they have this conditional here. They, of course, don't want to prejudice the civil and the religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine, recognizing that it will be nationally a Jewish state, but that there will be a minority. It does not say a Jewish state. You're absolutely right. It says a Jewish homeland, and there's been a lot of ink spilt on whether this refers to ultimately a state or a commonwealth, or is it just this vague homeland. You're absolutely right, although we'll see a little bit of clarification coming in about 6 years. Or the rights and status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So the recognition is that there might be some Jews who stay in England or in France or in Germany, even though conditions might not be so great. This was the... Zionism had existed already for a number of years. It was in the 1880s and 90s and the early part of the 20th century that, as we know, Jews began returning to the land of Israel. They began organizing themselves into societies to return. But there was no... it wasn't until Herzl in 1897 that you had the sense that we can all unite to do something about this. But there was no recognition by any national power other than Jews to affirm it. And so suddenly, just think about what it was like to be a Jewish resident in the land of Israel when the Balfour Declaration was issued. It was like, it was the closest thing to hearing a Declaration of Independence, although it was still far away. The Declaration of Independence was still far away. But think about it. The notion that the ruling power, or the power that's about to rule, is going to, in fact, view with favor the notion that this will be a homeland, it's the closest thing to July 4th that we can imagine. And just as proof, turn the page. I love this. This is a tombstone on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. Everybody see it? And it says, Eliezer ben Yehuda. Do we know who Eliezer ben Yehuda was? He was considered the father, you'll pardon the gendered nature of that appellation, of modern Hebrew. Because before he came along, you know, Jews spoke Yiddish, they spoke Ladino, they spoke all sorts of languages, but Hebrew was an antiquarian text. He helped transform it into a modern language that Jews could speak, and is now, of course, the national language of Israel, one of the national languages of Israel. But it's the language of the resurgence of Jewish culture. Well, he died in 1922, the very end of the year. Notice how he's described, Eliezer ben Yehuda, Mechayei HaLashon HaIvrit, the one who basically resurrected the Hebrew language, Umechaber HaMilon HaGadol, and the one who composed the great dictionary. Boy, wouldn't that be wonderful to have that on your tombstone? Composed the great dictionary. But it's true, he created a dictionary. And guess what? This was a case where usually, in most countries, in most societies, you first use the words, then they end up in the dictionary. With Eliezer ben Yehuda, he created the words in the dictionary, and then people using the dictionary began to use them. It's remarkable. It happens even to this very, very day. Niftar b'Yerushalayim, he died in Jerusalem. Bishnat ha-shishim b'chamesh li'yimei chayav, he died in the fifth year of his life. Kuvav Kislev, the 26th of Kislev, which is in December. It's, you know, Hanukkah comes in Kislev. Vav Lehatzharat Balfour, the sixth year of the Balfour Declaration. Think about it. Think about it. That says it all right there. It just gives you an idea what it meant to live with that dream. And yet, if you think about it, dying in 1922, it would be another 26 years before Israel would declare its independence. Okay. I think we could continue on with a few more texts, but all I'm going to do is just, I just want to share with you one little text to make it clear that not everyone was thrilled with the Balfour Declaration. And the best text to use is text number 7. Do you see that there? Edwin Montague. Anybody know who he was? He was the third Jewish member of the British cabinet in history. So you can imagine, it wasn't easy for him. Right? We're not talking... Anybody ever see that film about the Olympians in the First World War? What was that called? Chariots of Fire. Right, so I think that tries to capture the peculiar British approach to Jews. It was chilly at best, okay? By the way, anybody still remember Downton Abbey? I mean, it was only about a year and a half ago that we must have all watched that. And sure enough, you have a little bit of that upper crust antipathy toward the Jews in that. So we have Edwin Montague, and he's in the cabinet. And by the way, there's a longer version of this in your supplementary materials that you can obtain online or that you'll have in your booklet. But listen to what he says about Zionism. Who'd like to read this? It begins with the word Zionism. Anybody? Please.
Zionism has always seemed to me to be a mischievous political creed, untenable by any patriotic citizen of the United Kingdom.
Yeah. You're telling me Zionism, you want to go back to the land of Israel, you want to go back and create a homeland there. What about here in London? Aren't you at home here? I'm at home here. Aren't you at home here? Go on.
A Jewish Englishman sets his eyes on the Mount of Olives and longs for the day when he will shake British soil from his shoes and go back to agricultural pursuits in Palestine. He has always seemed to me to have acknowledged aims inconsistent with British citizenship and have admitted that he is unfit for a share in public life in Great Britain or to be treated as an Englishman.
Yeah, so the notion of dual loyalty is right here. And who's expressing it? A Jew, right? For him, it's a problem. It's a real problem to start wishing you were someplace else. And by the way, it wasn't just the British who felt this way. The next text is a text from the Reform Movement's famous Pittsburgh platform in 1885, where they were very clearly opposed to seeing a return to Zion as part of their dream. But as we can see already, and I'm just jumping over to page 5, in their Columbus platform in 1937, already they've made a dramatic shift, and now they are much more sympathetic toward the Zionist dream. So a lot has happened, and probably the most significant element in those 40 or so years was the Balfour Declaration itself, which made it clear, my God, if the British are telling us that we should have a homeland there, maybe it's okay, maybe we should. Okay, so this is our introduction to these texts.
Can I ask you a question? How can you ignore the history of the entire persecution from the time of the beginning of the diaspora through the beginning of the Balfour Declaration, where even the English had the Jews expelled from England.
Yeah, so what's your question?
My question is that how can a man like Montague not be aware of that history?
Fascinating. First of all, I don't really know what kind of an answer to give you. Because are you asking for a psychological answer? Are you asking how is it
a historical answer?
Well, it's very easy, and the answer is times change. the Britain of old was opposed to the Jews, but in that now we live as free citizens in Britain. You know, and I'll mention this, we all have to understand that in the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s, there was a movement called the Enlightenment. And with the Enlightenment, which created this great respect for rational thought and rational thinking, and all human beings are created equal, sounds familiar, we have the notion that Jews and other subhuman people should be, in fact, treated as if they are fully human, as if they have rights. And in society after society, they were granted citizenship. They were granted freedom. They were allowed to live within those host societies. As I mentioned in my sermon on Rosh Hashanah, you know, Theodor Herzl was born in 1860 in Budapest. And then when he was about 10 or 15 years old, his family moved to Vienna. That sounds very simple. It's not simple because in 1860, Jews couldn't live legally in Vienna. They were only permitted to live legally in Vienna in the 1860s, I believe. There were Jews who lived there, but they really weren't living there legally. So, you know, there is this dramatic shift. And the real question is, how do you relate to that shift? And the answer is, there were some Jews who, as soon as the laws were changed, felt that that made all the difference. And then there were some Jews, such as Theodor Herzl, there's a quote by him in the supplementary readings that I hope you'll look at, where he says, you know, the problem with what has happened in Europe is that all the laws have changed, but the sentiments of the people haven't changed. He focuses much more on the fact that even though technically we're allowed to live here, they still hate us, and they don't want us living here. So that's, I think, the answer to your question. Some people are focusing on one. Is that a hand up? And some are focusing on the other. Yes.
So the Balfour Declaration says that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country.
Yep.
So how does Montague come?
Because Montague is sensitive to the charge of dual loyalty. He as a British citizen, he understands how offensive it is to suggest that he has a loyalty to another nationality. That's a terror. You know, have we forgotten? I'm sure we are aware of just how tenuous and how delicate and how vulnerable Jews felt not too long ago in this country, and not just Jews, but many immigrant communities felt. And guess what? Many immigrant communities are feeling that way right now. The notion that you can be an American but still be considered to be loyal to some foreign state is a very, very touchy issue in almost any host country. Yes, quick answer, and then we're going to move on.
Could it be a generational thing, where the generation that grew up with the restrictions and not having full independence versus the generation that didn't grow up with them, they grew up with being considered...
Yes and no. I would agree with you that's a really reasonable explanation. In other words, the old-timers who remember the bad old days, they are less likely to believe this change, whereas the newcomers are willing to give it a shot. Possibly. You know, it's a very complex question. And I don't know that any of us can answer the question how we would behave in a comparable situation. If we were living in a society where Jews had only just been given rights, whether we would feel that there was enough to rely on, or whether we, you know, might feel still worried. You know, just to remind everybody, in, you know, 1776 and in the 1780s, you know, when America was founded, you know, Jews couldn't hold higher office. I know it's a shock to mention it, and maybe it's embarrassing to mention it, but it's true. You know, so frankly, even in this country in the early 1800s, It was touch and go. I think it was in the 1830s that Jews were lawfully permitted to hold higher office in Massachusetts. That's nice, because there was an election today, and we were allowed to vote, and Jews were allowed to be on the ballot. But in the 1820s, that wouldn't have been the case. Okay? So, if you don't mind, let's go on and let's watch. We're going to watch the very first part of this. You tell me what you think of Daniel Hartman's introduction to our class.